following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
So, hi, everybody who came here on a Thursday night. Bokushu and I were just having a conversation about the distinction between a presentation and expression. And so I think that's a kind of a good thing to hold in mind while trying to give a talk. So I don't know if I'll succeed in expressing rather than presenting. We'll see. But we can do that together somehow. My name is Gesho, and I'm a senior student here at Village Zendo. So I've been feeling recently that there is just an absolute panic going on in the world, in the whole world. And that it has, I'm sure it has many aspects, but there are two that are on my mind. One is climate. We're in a panic about this emergency and this crisis. And the other is, I think, not unrelated, where there's a generalized panic about the other coming to take what I have, the immigrant and the refugee. And it seems like our leaders are not helping. Our world leaders are not helping much. And it makes me feel sometimes like we're all running around with our hands in the air, hysterical. And at the same time, and maybe in exactly the same gesture, many of us, I'm sure no one in this room, many of us are paralyzed. We're overwhelmed. We don't know what to do. It's so huge. And that makes this situation have some of the same kind of impossibility that a koan does. And in a way, I do think it's our collective big karmic, even though I'm not fond of that word, koan, that we as all humans now have together. And so sometimes I find like koans unlock other koans. They're like keys and they're like locks at the same time. And so I thought, especially since this is what Dharma talks do, that I would bring a koan for us to kind of place against this other large koan. So some of us were on the retreat, maybe not everybody. We have a study text that we've been working with on the retreat, and we'll be having another couple months with it. And it's a book called Zen Echoes, and it's an amazing book. It's a translation of a 17th century collection of poems written about koans. So you have the koans, and then you have these poetic commentaries. And they're written by female Chan masters in China. The word Chan makes you say master, made me miss it. Chan masters. And so there's three of them. The first is Miao Zong, and she lived and wrote in the 12th century. And then 500 years after that, these two women who were Chan masters and friends, Bao Qi and Zhu Kui, were inspired by her example and added their own verse commentaries, their own poems, to the collection. And it was all published back in the 17th century as the Concordant Sounds Collection of Verse Commentaries. And it's recently been translated and now published by, translated by a scholar named Beata Grant. And she's done some other amazing work. I've read some of her other work. So there's a koan in this collection that I want us to sit with a little bit. And the reason I'm kind of laughing is because it's like a big mouthful of a koan. It's one of the most famous koans, which is Nan Kwan Kills a Cat. So there have been many, many masters who've commented on this koan, and there's much to say about many aspects. I'm not going to try to do all that. We're just going to look at a little piece of it. So the koan takes place at Nan Kwan's monastery. He was a very well-known Zen master who lived from 748 to 835, and he was the student of a very famous master, Matsu, and he was also the teacher of Zhao Xu, who we also know as Joshu, also very famous, and Joshu appears in this koan as well. He's the one who was asked, does a dog have a Buddha nature? So the story goes like this. So apparently this monastery had two halls where monks lived and worked, the West Hall and the East Hall. And the monks in the West Hall were fighting and arguing with the monks in the East Hall about a cat. And in some commentaries, they think the cat was like a kitten that they wanted as a pet, and they were arguing about who was going to keep the cat. And in other commentaries, they're like, no, they were arguing Buddhist philosophy. Does a cat have Buddha nature? We don't know. So they were arguing and had obviously just sort of lost themselves in this argument. And Nanquan, their master, their Roshi, saw them, and he grabbed the cat, and he went and got his sword, and he held up the cat in front of the monks, and he said, if you can say one word of Zen, I will spare this cat. Otherwise, I will cut it in two. And the monks were just completely silenced. They were speechless. They were paralyzed. They couldn't do anything. And according to the koan, Nanquan killed the cat. So later, Zhao Zhu came back to the monastery. He had been out, and he heard the story. And he took off his shoes, his sandals, and he put them on his head, and he just walked away. And as he was walking away, Nanquan said, if only you had been here earlier, I could have saved the cat. Funny or sad, right? Both, right? Which? So let's just pause a moment to take in the story with all its feelings. And while we do that, I want to turn back to the question of what is happening right now in the world. So a few weeks ago, David Loy was here. He wrote a book called Echo Dharma, and I went to hear his talk because I'm really interested in this whole connection between Buddhism and climate crisis. And his main point that he was talking about was that he felt that Buddhism, Buddhist philosophy, was the medicine that we need in the world right now to be able to respond better to this. And he had a lot of really wonderful things to say. And as he was speaking, he also called to my mind other people who had written about this and worked in this way. And I just want to kind of invoke a couple of them for anybody who's, like me, really interested in this topic and wants to kind of follow it down one or another path. And one is Joanna Macy, and she wrote a book called World as Lover, World as Self. She's a scholar who's like around 90 now, and has developed this series of workshops about basically ending paralysis in relation to this exact question. They remind me a little of Bernie Glassman's Bearing Witness workshops, although I don't think they're so lengthy. And the other one is Stephanie Kaza, and she is a longtime Soto Zen practitioner. She used to live in Vermont, and she's written a lot of interesting books, one of which is a beautiful book about attention to trees, but also one called Green Buddhism, which takes up this same subject. So, and the reason I wanted to invoke them was also to remind us all that we're not alone in thinking about this, and that there's been this movement of this particular kind of response and thought that's been rising up now over many decades. So it's not new, and I think that's a good thing. And then his title, Echo Dharma, also made me think of Alan Watts. So I discovered Alan Watts many years ago, and it kind of blew my mind. It was before I was sitting, before I was part of this Sangha. And one of the things that I heard early on was a talk he gave called Echo Zen. And you can find it online. And I totally personally recommend the talks, not the books, if you are choosing. Because there's something he's able to do in the talks, which, at least for me, I haven't been able to have come alive in the books in the same way. And he has a vision of the way in which Buddhism, and in particular Zen, because of its infusion of Taoism from China, has a way of talking, of something very specific to offer about how we meet the world. what the world is, what we are. And he particularly emphasizes what we often around here call non-separation. I remember when I was first sitting here, I was like, non-separation is the only real idea that Zen has. There's no other ideas, just this one idea, which was sort of thrilling and sort of terrifying at the same time. I still kind of think it's true. And, you know, another word we give some aspects of that is emptiness. So you hear people talk about it. And Alan Watts begins with this observation, which you might have encountered. He says, so when in Western societies you ask people to point out themselves, they point this way. And they usually, sometimes they point to their heart, but mostly they point to their heads. And he says that we often grow up feeling as if we're like a little person sitting behind the eyes, and we're taking in all the vision that comes through the eyes, and we're getting a transmission of the sound through the ears, and we're working the levers that control the limbs, and we're thinking the thoughts and making the decisions and dreaming the dreams. We're a little person sitting behind the eyes in a bag of skin. And when I first heard him say that, it felt very accurate to my own experience, very accurate to mine. So I was really struck by it. And sometimes we also feel ourselves to be our bodies. It's unclear, do we have our bodies, do we have a car, or are we our bodies? Our society's a little confused about that. But for the most part, most people feel as if their self ends for sure at the boundary of their skin. It doesn't go any farther. And I think it's this idea of the self that is really fundamental to our sense of separation. And I think that this idea of what the self is exactly the delusion or the hallucination that the Buddha woke up from. So, what are we? What are we? We're a blank page. Yeah. So I could go down this path for a long time, and I think I'm a little mindful of time. So rather than waxing poetically about what I think we are, I'm going to go on a little bit with Alan Watts. And he says something quite striking in this talk, Echo Zen. We don't have to agree with him, right? We can just hold it in mind. He says the object of Buddhist discipline, and I think he very particularly means Zen, is to bring about a state of affairs in which the individual feels themselves to be everything that there is. The whole cosmos focused, expressing itself here. So in that way, your sense of identity gets kind of turned inside out. So rather than, you know, you being the center, looking out at this strange world through these eyes, it is you expressing itself. And he says, you won't, you know, if you have this intuition, if you come to this feeling, you don't forget your name and address and telephone number, or your day job, or what role you play. But you do. You might have a sense that that role is a fiction. And the metaphor that he gives for this inside-out sense of who you are is a wave on the ocean. And he has a lot of metaphors and explanations in his talks. It's one of his characteristics. And so when we think about the ocean and a wave, it's obvious that the wave is continuous with the ocean. It is the ocean. There's no way to like chop it off and take it away. And that it's created from all of the forces of the whole ocean. But it also is a very specific expression happening right here, right now, one very particular, spontaneous, precise form, a lively moment of particularity. And that's what he thinks we are, or something like that. So let's see what our Chan masters have to say about this koan and how this connects up. So if we start with Miaozong, her verse commentary says, Nanquan brandished his sword and sliced the cat in two. Giving and taking life is something only masters understand. The authority seems on this morning to be in his hands. Watch carefully for when the order is to be carried out. So watch carefully, she says, for when the order is to be carried out. When exactly is the cat cut in two? And there's some controversy among all these commentators on this koan about whether Nanquan actually materially killed an actual historical cat with his physical sword, whether this is more of a metaphor, or whether even it said he killed the cat, but really he didn't because he's like a Buddhist. Of course he wouldn't kill the cat. So there's a lot of, But let's look again at what Miaozong said. Nanquan brandished his sword and sliced the cat in two. Giving and taking life is something only masters understand. The authority seems on this morning to be in his hands. Watch carefully for when the order is to be carried out. So if we think for a moment of this koan as if it were a dream, which is something I sometimes do with koans, and in that dream, all the characters are aspects of yourself interacting with each other. So one part of you is the cat. One aspect of you is the arguing monks, and you are also Nanquan, and you're also Zhao Zhu. And if you see it in that way, when exactly is the cat split in two? And I might say that the cat is split in two as soon as the monks see it as separate from themselves, as a thing that can be argued about, as a being that is bounded by its fur. And Nanquan holds this cat up to them like a mirror, and he asks them to speak and to respond, and they can't. And they can't respond, I would say, perhaps, because they are caught in their own separation. If they understood their true relation to the cat, they would leap up as one body to stop Nanquan. There would be no hesitation at all. Their communication would be, whatever form it was in, urgent and immediate and spontaneous and live and meaningful. And when Zhao Zhu comes back and walks away with his sandals on his head, for him, that is that response, that unhesitating response. And I hear sorrow in his sandals, and I hear mourning, but that's me. And Chan Master Baoqi, she has a lighter take. She says, Zhao Zhu was secretly pleased to have claimed the advantage. He was sure Nanquan had missed out on the first challenge. But although he escaped with the straw sandals on his head, Nanquan understood that there had never been a live cat. So Baoqi wants to turn our understandings all on their heads. So for her, Zhao Zhu was pleased, Nanquan missed the boat, there was never a live cat. Her friend, Chan Master Zhu Kui, comes from a kind of opposite direction. She says, how frightful were the talons and teeth of the wild cat. Lifting it up, Nanquan clear-mindedly put it in the ditch. If he'd been able to get the monks of both halls to speak, would Nanquan still have brought down his sword or not? So Baoqi wonders if the cat had ever been alive, but Zhu Kui wonders if Nanquan would have killed the cat no matter what the monks said or did. Zhu Kui's cat is dangerous, and Nanquan must clear-mindedly put it into a ditch. And I think both Baoqi's and Zhu Kui's cats are cats of separation. I mean, that's what I think the danger is. So they are the world that we fail to see as part of our own bodies. And in that separation, in that moment of hesitation, it's a fatal moment where everything is lost. And one might think that Nanquan's sword is what saves us from that moment, that paralysis. And we might think it's like Manjushri's sword. So Manjushri sits in every Zen temple holding this sword that is what separates us from our delusions. So let's for a moment see Nan Quan as holding up our whole Earth, the planet we are arguing about all the time. And he says to us, if you can say one word, I will save this world. Who here will save this world? And I think this is actually happening. This is happening to all of us right here, right now, like we're all. And in our panic and in our separation, we freeze and we're paralyzed and we are overwhelmed and we hesitate. I'm sure not everyone here hesitates. I'm sure everybody's responding beautifully, but I'm hesitating. I'm paralyzed. And in that hesitation, everything we love is lost. It's my own feeling that we cannot respond to this crisis, this planet-wide crisis, if we feel the Earth to be a thing that is separate from us. If we feel the migrant and the refugee as other than ourselves. If we feel the trees, bugs, mushrooms, oceans, skies, mountains as separate from ourselves. And the cities and the sirens and the factories and the mines as separate from ourselves, because it's not just the pretty stuff. While we were on retreat, I had a series of very funny encounters with an odd sort of sentient being. As some of you may have noticed, if you had been there, that the warmth of the building had attracted some insects. In particular, these brown marmorinated stink bugs, little stink bugs. And during the week, I found one on my cushion, I found one on my bed, I found one on my robe. And as I was officiating, there was one on the altar crawling through the lavender. And I took, one by one, I took them all out. The one on the altar I just left there, but the rest I took outside. And if you investigate this insect, which I was moved to do, you'll find that virtually all of the internet has turned against this insect. It is an invasive species, which it is, accidentally introduced from Asia through our global system of travel and shipping. It was first seen in Pennsylvania in 1998, and so it hasn't really been here very long, but it's thrived. It's doing really well here. And it's not very lovely to human tastes. If you attack it, it emits a smell, a stink. It damages crops, especially fruits, and it comes into your house in the winter, sometimes in huge swarms. It's really, could be frightening, and everything you read is about how to get rid of it. But I was really struck by the creatureliness of this little being and the way it stepped very delicately over these complex surfaces. And it seemed to move slowly, but at the same time advance quite quickly. And it could travel these very long distances. And on its feet were these like tiny little prongs of some kind. I couldn't see them, but if you tried to lift it off of a piece of fabric, it clung, and it was hard to get it off. And in this habitat, it's an invader. But someplace, it's at home in the world. And even in this foreign place, it carries a world with it. It creates a world as it walks over our altar with Manjushri watching. I've come to feel that we can't save a world we do not love. I had this crazy fantasy while I was up at Garrison that each person on the whole planet, but even just each person within the range of my voice, each person would choose a species out of the 8.7 million, that's how many there are species on the Earth. And many of those species are tiny, hard to see, hard to like. It's not all pandas, dolphins, eagles. It's diatoms and molds and stink bugs and hydra, these tiny hydra. And I mention them because Sagan, who's in our sangha, studies hydra. And they're about this big. They live in freshwater ponds. And they're amazing, actually. She's talked to me a little bit about them. They have so few neurons, you can actually count them. But they have neurons, which not everybody does. And they can't die. They don't age. So they can't die like of aging. They can only be killed. and they bud, and they also reproduce sexually. And she's studying them to try to understand the human brain. And in particular, she's studying them to understand how they know what is themselves and what is not themselves. So she's studying their sense of the self. And I wonder what it would be like if each species had a person like that, right? Had a knowledgeable steward, someone who chose to love it, to know it as best they could, to look after it and its interests, to watch over it for its own sake. I think in order for us to respond to this crisis, we have to feel it intimately. So Zuckwe wrote two poems about this koan, and I'm going to kind of close by talking about the second one. It has a very different feeling from her first. She says, "Below the sharp sword, both were good at turning the body. There is nobody walking under the moon along the old road. That which was blocked has been transmitted and flourishes. At the golden gates, the secret armies halt by imperial decree." So both Nanquan and Cao Su were good at turning the body. Each of them could speak in a way that caused a transformation. And once that transformation has happened, there's no one left, no self left, to walk under the moon on the old road. The blockage collapses. The Dharma is transmitted. And then I think the last line is a bit mysterious. What are the golden gates, and what are the secret armies, and what is the imperial decree? I do think maybe the imperial decree is Nanquan's action. With his sword, he restores the cat, which had been split in two. And as for the armies and the gate, I leave them for you to find in yourself what those might be. There is nobody walking under the moon along the old road.